afternoon. Here we go again. It's Friday, you all. 4 p.m., San Francisco Village Voice, La Voz de San Pancho, where everybody got a voice. And today we got a fabulous guest for you all, Phil Berg, my excellent friend, who is running for Congress as a libertarian.
Hi, Misha.
Hey, I am so excited to have you here. And I understand I gave you false instructions on how to get to the joint.
Yes.
And I'm so grateful that you figured it out. Phil, you're quite a fascinating guy. I met you through Michael Denny, mm-hmm. another friend who is also in the Libertarian Party. And I would like to ask you some very simple questions, because when I first heard about libertarian, as a layperson who doesn't really know much about politics except how to fight law enforcement brutality, mm-hmm. I was hearing all kinds of crazy feedback like, oh, they are the Nazi party. Oh, there's nothing worse than a Republican except for a libertarian.
Right.
Why don't you tell us? Let's imagine, for example, that you're meeting for the first time a young dude who is 18 and about to vote and say, what the heck is the Libertarian Party? What a libertarian means? Where does it come from? And what is the platform? What is the agenda of the Libertarian Party?
Rodney King once said, why can't we get along? And I've been trying to answer that question for a very long time. And the Libertarian Party's fundamental philosophy is that we all can get along without violence. And so when the Libertarian Party was formed in 1971 in a living room in Denver, Colorado by a guy named Noland,
right.
it was a unity of people from the far right and the far left who realized that they had to stop fighting. And realize that the common enemy is the government. And really, the common enemy is violence. And so,
what is the purpose of violence from the government?
The purpose of violence from the government is to maintain power for those who are connected. The government has always been about violence from its very beginning. The very beginnings of government are violence. People, especially in San Francisco, like to imagine the government as kind and good. But the essence of government is that it has the monopoly on violence.
It's evil.
It's evil. Government is evil. And so the Libertarian Party wants to have a society based on no initiation of violence except against people who have already initiated violence on somebody else.
Mm.
And so it's trying, because the government's essence is violence, it's trying to make the government as small as possible so that its only job is to get the bad guys. And that means defending the country, prosecuting murderers, thieves, and fraud artists, and protecting people's property from theft and pollution. And trying to limit its scope to just that. Now, this is the essence of liberalism. The last 300 years have seen a tremendous revolution in humanity. Before the British liberalization and then the American liberalization, people used to belong to the state or they belonged to the church. So there was no such thing as the individual. The individual was a foreign concept to everybody. People existed to do the bidding of the king, mm-hmm. who existed to do the bidding of the pope.
Mm-hmm.
And so no individual had real value. The value, and we had two revolutions that happened in the last few hundred years, a religious one and a secular one. In the religious revolution, was the Martin Luther saying, no, each person is holy unto themselves, and each person has value. And in the secular revolution, came from basically the founding fathers, and also in the Brit and same time in Britain with the revolution against the king by Oliver Cromwell just before the American Revolution. And both of those revolutions were the beginning of the idea that each individual is a value in unto themselves, and they don't exist to serve the purposes of the government. And this was the great principle of the U.S. It was very, very flawed when it first started. And people today cite the founding fathers as evil slave owners who were rich white men who were not progressive. But it's not fair to do that to them, because their ideas were extremely progressive in comparison to what went before them. And now their ideas laid the groundwork ultimately for the inclusion of the idea that not only are white men's souls valuable, but everybody's souls are valuable. Women's souls are valuable. Every race's souls are valued.
Mentally ill, disabled people?
Mentally ill people, Yay! Disabled people, and this has been an evolution, but it's the framework that they set that enabled this flowering of the idea that every human being is precious. And now this idea is starting to spread as we're richer and more people are able to survive and not scraping out just barely scraping out a living. More and more people are able to even extend that vision to primates and even to many other animals. And so you have vegetarianism is even a growing philosophical occurrence because we all realize that doing violence, not doing violence to other human beings, because they're each of them is of value, is not doing violence to our planet.
So the premise of the libertarian ideology is really to value each life as a precious life. It sounds slightly different from the grassroots perspective, where the village, the concept of the village, the strength of the us versus I, tend to prevail right now to give a voice to the poor, to the silent.
Right, and it's great to have a village, but the village needs to be voluntary. So the libertarians are all for socialism from the ground up, a voluntary socialism.
How different are you from the International Socialist Party, for example? What makes you different? What makes you unique as a libertarian?
The international socialists, unfortunately, tend to view socialism from the top down, that we have to impose socialism, that we have to impose socialism on the greedy rich people and take their money by force to give it to the poor. And this seems at first like a very good idea, but there's a couple problems with it. And Winston Churchill once said it the best. Winston Churchill has a lot of character problems himself, but we could get to that later.
Apparently, he was severely dyslexic. He had to get an underwriter for all his material. He could hardly spell. That's amazing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He certainly. I know that he said his S's like that, but he said that the problem with capitalism or free markets is that some people get very rich. And the problem with socialism is that everybody is poor. Now, all men are created equal under the law. So the law has to treat everybody equally. But the
Except
fact
that the law is really protecting corporate interests and not individuals.
Yes, and that's true. We can get to that later. Let me just finish this first thought. So because all men are created equal under the law and should be treated equally under the law, and that's extremely important. But Mother Nature is unfair. And Mother Nature makes some people great at baseball. Some people make some people fabulous singers. makes some people extremely intelligent, makes some people great salesmen, makes some people lousy salesmen and horrible business people, makes some people not able to read, makes some people crazy and not able to even think
unfit
straight.
Parents.
Some people unfit parents. So there's all kinds of inequalities in the way people are born. Now, to try to impose by force equal results on what Mother Nature has done unequally is a very nice idea, to try to force everybody to be the same wealth level. But the problem with that is that that means you have to take from the most successful. And that destroys the incentive for the most successful people to be as successful as they can be. If your most successful people have their knees cut off, then your whole society is robbed of the fruits of the labors of the most successful. And it doesn't really help the poor people at all. And so saying things like, we're going to kill the rich, or we're going to take from the rich, I think it's a great idea to steal from the rich who stole to get their money. But a lot of people, and I've had this discussion with you before,
right.
But a lot of people, especially when the society is nonviolent and designed so that the government doesn't steal from one group of people to give to the other, those are the real thieves. The government's the real thieves. And there's a lot of advantaged people who then tie themselves to the government to then steal from everybody else. And a lot of it's very subtle. And so the people, and so this is getting real complicated, isn't it? So, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just waiting to hear at some point, where does a libertarian stand then about the value of the revolution?
The value of the American Revolution or the value of the coming revolution?
Impending revolution.
The impending revolution. The libertarians would very much like to have a bloodless revolution without violence.
Can that be achieved?
It happened in Russia.
Right.
And we are committed, because in order to join the Libertarian Party, when the Libertarian Party was formed, there was the weathermen who were blowing up buildings. And they didn't really get anywhere. All they did was help entrench the power of the feds, because Americans don't like violence. But, you know, when the government shot somebody at Kent State, that was the end of the Vietnam War. So Americans don't like violence on either side. But they're getting more and more immune to it as time goes by. It's a very dangerous thing. And so the Libertarian Party, from its very beginning, decided to have a pledge. In order to become a capital L libertarian, you have to sign a pledge that you will not espouse the initiation of violence for any reason. And so we are hoping to have a revolution of ending strife, ending violence, and in the more the tradition of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King than of Malcolm X.
How many people of color in the Libertarian Party would you say?
We have very few.
And why is that?
That's a very good question.
What is your analysis of it?
I think it's because we are over, a lot of us are over intellectual. And
Watch out. Some of us people of color are intellectual.
We've got some few intellectual, we got a few intellectual black folks in our organization. We would love to have more. It's really, you notice I've come to events
always.
In Hunter's Point.
Phil Berg has been coming to all our events, the Poetry Slam against the death penalty, civil rights cookouts, and on last Sunday, our benefit for the families of Oliver Lafitte and Asa Sullivan were killed by the police. So I know that you care, you demonstrate it. It's not only about the elections.
Right. I realistically, it's very unlikely I'm going to win this election. But the education is extremely important, and laying the groundwork is very important.
So are you saying that you're running for awareness, to bring awareness?
I want to bring awareness.
Such as Barbara Becknell running for governor?
Yes. I met Barbara at one of your events, didn't I?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's for awareness. It's for education. And if I can bring black folks into our movement, especially black leaders into movement, it would be the most important thing I could do. I posted that. Our discussion board is called lpsf.org.
Okay.
And on that discussion board, after one of the events I went to at Hunter's Point, I said there would be nothing more powerful than getting a really good black caucus of libertarians, and especially starting here, because San Francisco and the Bay Area is the intellectual leaders historically of all of African Americans in the U.S. There's here in Harlem, it's very powerful.
Or Atlanta?
I think historically the Black Panther started here. The ideas of African Americans in the San Francisco Bay Area has been extremely powerful in the United States and great influence. And I would love to see that embrace the libertarian ideas of nonviolence. I would like to think that had the intellectual framework of libertarians is relatively new. It's growing all the time, and I really hope that I can be an instrument to spreading it to the African American community and gets embraced. It's a really tough thing to do because, the left has a whole mythology that's sort of self-contained, and it's really hard. It's hard for people to change their minds if people have an identity with a certain group. Especially if most of the people in their group have that identity, it's really hard to change it. So that's why you were always told, well, the libertarians are just like Republicans, because people need to put people in either the in the right or the left. Well, we in the libertarian camp, we like to think we're up. We're not right or left. We're up.
Phil, when did you decide to become a libertarian? Why not a Democrat or a Green, for example?
I was a Democrat my whole life. My family was Democrats. I grew up in Baltimore City, the same city as Nancy Pelosi. It's a very African-American city, a very black city. I grew up in a nice academic Jewish enclave, but I went to I don't remember the exact percentage, but let's put it this way. There weren't too many white faces in my junior high school.
Right.
So maybe 95% black junior high school.
So you had good exposure.
Yeah.
Okay.
My high school was about a third black, also public school.
Right.
My elementary school was a real funny kind of historical. I'm 50 years old, so this is kind of an historical thing. The little enclave that I lived in had a stream that flowed down the middle of it, and along the stream was old antebellum row houses, about 10 row houses. And in that little neighborhood was still black folks who probably were the descendants of slaves who served in that area, Baltimore, when it was vacation homes for people from the inner city. Because it was still the city, but it was kind of a woodsy, hilly part of the city. So we had black kids in my elementary school in first, second, third grade. One was Melvin Rosenberg. So you can kind of get a picture of what the history was there. And poor Melvin was lousy at football like me and all those other things. Then in '63, we started busing. So we got about 20% of my elementary school then came from Cherry Hill.
Yes.
And I couldn't understand why these kids didn't bathe. Why didn't their mothers give them a bath before they came? And, I just didn't understand. I was a little kid, didn't understand the tremendous poverty that they were coming from.
Right.
But there were some of those kids were really smart, and they were bright, and they were athletic. And I really loved them. And there was a guy named Baldy who did the Baldy walk and was tall. And we had a lot of fun together. And the one time I got sent to the principal's office is because I was cutting it up with Baldy from the projects all the way on the other side of town. Big section of South Baltimore and the industrial part of Baltimore got just a swath of housing projects. And that's where all these kids were from. But so I'm sitting there and Lyndon Johnson comes and he promises the Great Society. And I'm watching Baltimore change. And it's and nothing's happening. As a matter of fact, it's getting worse and worse and worse. There's more and more people. This is not, and Baltimore has a large element, not an element, that's not a good word, a large number of people who came from Appalachia, mm-hmm. poor white people, who came to work in the shipyards along with the black folks mm-hmm. in World War II and just crowded into all the row houses in town. And in the 50s, almost everybody had a decent blue-collar job in the town. And the first ones to lose their jobs were the black folks. Mm-hmm. So I know it's not politically correct, but this is just the way things were in the early 60s. When I was like 5 or 6, we had a housekeeper. Her name was Melissa Holmes, and I loved Melissa. She taught me how to snap my fingers. She taught me how to jive. She told me she was happy when she won the lottery. She told me all kinds of stories about her life. Anyway, Melissa's husband worked Bethlehem Steel. And in 1959 or 1960, as the steel industry began its decline from its peak in World War II, John Holmes, Melissa's husband, lost her job. And Melissa was devastated. And I was devastated. And that's when I began to really wonder, you know, why do people lose their jobs? And then, of course, my father lost his job in 62. And that was really tough on my family. And then he did all these other odd jobs and was involved in a terrible traffic accident, went to the city hospital for 6 months, and fortunately my mom got a half decent job that she kept for many, many years selling magazines for Scholastic magazines. But we lived in a neighborhood where everybody was a lot wealthier than we were. Mm. So it was very difficult, especially those years when my dad struggled. But getting back to John Holmes and then wondering what's going on, why are people suffering, and then watching it spread. There were pockets of poverty when I was young, but they were just pockets. And Baltimore would receive every great society program. Because we were close to Washington, we had a Democratic legislature and city all the time, and the bureaucrats in Washington were very close by, so they liked to give money to Baltimore. And everything just kept getting worse and worse, and more people kept losing their jobs. When I went to college, because Barry Commoner was there, the great socialist economist and ecologist, I never saw much of Dr. Commoner. I only met him once. But I was determined to learn biology and economics, thinking that if I just learned this stuff, I could really understand how John Holmes could keep his job and we could save the environment at the same time. Because the neighborhood I grew in actually had primeval forest in it because it was so hilly. And it also was a covenant on some of the land nearby that kept that land. There were 300-year-old oak trees in my backyard. The biggest trees I've ever seen outside of California were in my backyard. So I wanted to save the environment and I wanted to help the economy because I thought both were important, and I still think both are important. So I went to Wash U. I studied economics. I aced it. I graduated cum laude. The economics professors loved me. I knew how to make the Keynesian happy, but I really believed in the Chicago guys, the free market guys. Those are the guys who really convinced me. The Keynesian guys, actually one of them was a brilliant guy, and now I see much of his theories were correct, related to instability in the so-called capitalist economy, because we don't have a capitalist economy. We have a fascist economy, but that's for later. So I studied this economics, and you know, I came back and I moved back to Baltimore, and my best friend's dad was a professor of biostatistics at the School of Hygiene and Public Health. So I went to the School of Hygiene and Public Health and majored in environmental health engineering. And Hopkins Medical Campus is in the middle of East Baltimore, and for lack of a better word, it's the middle of the ghetto, and it's really a bad situation. And it was a bad situation when I was in high school. I went down there and tried to tutor a kid. His name was Eric Moss. It didn't work very well, and I ended up getting the getting beaten up very severely just by being a naive kid in the wrong place in that neighborhood. And so there's a, the faculty had a swimming pool. I love that swimming pool. But it's the funny thing because Hopkins is like this plantation in the middle of the ghetto.
Right.
And there you are sitting in a swimming pool. It's like from a novel. It's like from a cheap novel. So you're swimming, you're sitting in this swimming pool, this beautiful swimming pool, hot summer Baltimore day, and you look across the street and there's these row houses that were, you know, built for slaves probably in the 1880s, 1890s, and the third floor is uninsulated, and it's 100 degrees, and you see the people in the windows looking at your cool pool with no air conditioning. And this is 1976.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there thinking, this is 76, and still nothing's happening. These folks are just sitting here sweating. So what's going on? You know, so I still was a Democrat, but, you know, not very enthusiastic. I had worked very hard in 72 for George McGovern, very hard in 68 for Hubert Humphrey. Then in 85, still answering your question how I became a libertarian, I went to a public health reunion of all the public health schools in the Baltimore, Washington area over in Washington. And it's a very straight group of people. So, and I only found one gay guy in my school of public health who I'm still friends with today. It's absolutely insane. We're still good friends. We met looking at a piece of dog poop I was under a microscope. I was looking at a piece of dog poop under a microscope. We were doing parasitology. And it's still hard for both of us to go to a sushi restaurant. So I was just all these good looking guys in the public health meeting, but nobody for me. So I was kind of sad and didn't have a boyfriend at the time. So I went to the Lost and Found, and there was this really cute guy, and I walked up to him and I said, "Would you like to dance?" And he said, "No." And I thought he said yes. So I grabbed him and we went on the dance floor and we danced and, you know, we did the usual negotiating and he agreed to come home with me. And we got in my car and for some reason the radio station had changed and I don't know how, but somehow I had on this Christian radio station that was really hardcore and right wing.
Right.
And very full of hate.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Get that off the radio," and he loved that. And so we started talking, and it turns out that he was a libertarian objectivist and studying philosophy at the George Mason Graduate School, which is an objectivist philosophy department and a libertarian economics department. And unfortunately, it's on the other side of Washington from Baltimore, so it was a little bit difficult. And we were pretty tight for a while until he dropped out of graduate school to go back to his boyfriend in Chico. And that's what sort of brought me out to California, too.
Wow.
So I discovered...
what a venture.
I discovered liberty. He gave me a book. He gave me Murray Rothbard's book called Man, Economy, and State. And he gave me a great book on the causes of the Great Depression. And another really terrific book on what the government has done to your money, also by Murray Rothbard. Murray Rothbard's a great guy, big fat Jewish guy, loved his corned beef sandwiches. And I heard a great quote from him the other day. Another libertarian told me he was eating a lot. And I said, "You know, eating that much food's not good for you." He said, "Murray Rothbard once said that every calorie says yes to life." So I think that answers your question.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes, it does. Now, I've heard you several times explain in public meetings and some of our heated discussions how the banking system is actually the core of the evil web that is choking us all.
Right.
Can you tell us a little more about that?
Okay. If you get $100, you earn $100. Poor man earns $100. Works, does some hard work, either with his body or with his brain, and earns $100 and puts it in a drawer to save it. And he comes back in a year, and it's only worth $90.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the question is, who stole the $10? Right. Well, I'll tell you who stole the $10. A guy in a business suit writes a plan to sell dog food on the internet. He takes it to a banker. The banker gives him $100 because the internet's hot. Who gives him $100 million.
Right.
He takes $20 million. He spends it on a nice mansion in Atherton, a Jaguar, a couple Beamers. He hires his friends. Anyway, he tries to put together a website. It doesn't work out. He goes bankrupt on the $100 million. Okay, the money's gone. All the resources are wasted. And that's where the $10 went. So that might be an extreme example of the wastefulness.
Oh, that's pretty graphic. It speaks to me.
Yeah. So when I told this to Pam Pam on KPU, yeah. she said, man, she said, that's like stealing the bread without breaking the crust.
There you go.
So in the old days, people, and nobody likes to talk about the old days, but there's a Santayana's a famous philosopher, and not the singer, but a philosopher. he said, if you ignore history, you're doomed to repeat it. Mm-hmm. So the history now is very similar. The history for the whole world is very similar to what happened in Germany in the 1920s.
That's right.
And I read a fabulous paper the other day, which compared the 1920s Germany to today. It was a review of a Thomas Mann book about life in the 20s, mm-hmm. a short story, actually, from an Austrian economic perspective. But it talked about fashion. It talked about McMansions in 1830. It talked about all kinds of – it talked about the way people dressed. It talked about male hustlers in Germany in the 20s. It talked about all the issues of moral decay and how it's all tied to money. So the problem is that once the central bank was permitted to print as much money as it could with absolutely no controls, it's gone completely berserk. In 1974, when Nixon slapped on emergency price controls, the inflation rate was only 4%. Now the government claims it's under 4%, but it's an absolute lie. Because
there was the figure, do you think?
There's a website called shadowstatistics.org, and it takes all the government statistics and it recalculates them using their original formulas from the 60s. And if you use the original formulas from the 60s, you get an unemployment rate of 9%, which is terrible. Mm-hmm. And you get an inflation rate of 9%.
Wow.
So
we're almost going to the inflation in Peru and Brazil with those figures.
We're rapidly heading there. And it's very, very destructive of the society. And we're lucky if it only stays at 9%. Because what happens is when you create money out of thin air, you are constantly robbing from the people and giving to the advantaged. So here's the way it works. Say Halliburton hands Bush a bill for $1 billion for work in Iraq, with quotations around the word work. Now, and suppose the tax receipts aren't enough to pay for the billion dollar bill. So then Bush goes to the bank. He has the Treasury print a bond up out of paper. It says, we owe you $1 billion, and we'll pay you back in 30 years plus mm-hmm. interest. Mm-hmm. And then they put it at auction, and all the banks, bid on it. And the banks will buy that for $1 billion, and whoever agrees to take the lowest interest rate gets to buy the bond. Mm-hmm. So now the bank owns the bond, and let's say the bank's going to agree to get 4% or something. Now, the Fed wants to, the Fed wants the federal government to be able to sell these bonds. And suppose the banks are getting a little bit too many bonds and interest rates are going up. So that what the Fed will do is then just buy those bonds. But it'll, if it wants to create more money, I know this sounds complicated, and it is a little bit complicated.
No, so far I'm with you.
Okay. So the Fed prints, just pushes a button. Doesn't even have to print anything. It just pushes a button that says, buy a bond. And it prints a button that gives the bank $1 billion, and it takes the bond. It puts it in its warehouse and starts collecting interest on it. And it makes an entry in its books because it has to keep its books balanced. Assets, $1 billion bond. Liabilities, $1 billion cash out to Citicorp or Chase. Mm-hmm. So it just created $1 billion out of thin air. Mm. Now that $1 billion is sitting in Chase's accounts. It can buy more bonds from the federal government with it, or it can lend it out to GM, or it can lend it out to Fannie Mae to buy a McMansion.
It sounds like a foolproof system.
It's a terrible system.
How do you dismantle that? As a libertarian, how do you go after the cartels and the banks? And the implication is huge because we're not talking about locally or nationally. It's internationally.
Right.
Talk about your platform and the concrete steps to dismantle the banking system.
First of all, everybody, I say this is too radical. It can't be done. Everybody gets scared because they're used to their money in their pocket and they think it'll all disappear. But let me tell you this. This is the fourth national bank of the United States. The Democratic Party was started, and it's got its, I believe, its first president. You historians out there, please correct me if I'm wrong. What number should they call? What's the phone number?
Yeah.
Yeah.
864-1006.
And that's area code 415.
That's right.
Okay, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but Andrew Jackson became president on the platform of disestablishing the first National Bank of the U.S., which was established by Alexander Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Now, Alexander Hamilton was a problem for the second president of the United States, Adams. The first president was George Washington. The second president was John Adams. John Adams basically wrote the Constitution with Thomas Jefferson. Right. John Adams was kind of a really straight arrow guy, but he had some great ideas. And he wasn't a perfect president. He did the Alien Sedition Act. He did some other evil things. Just like he predicted when he was writing the Constitution, he said once the politicians have power, they're going to do horrible stuff. And that's why the Constitution was made to limit the power of the government. Right. And John Adams was a perfect example of doing bad stuff. But he had tremendous problems with Alexander Hamilton because Alexander Hamilton really wanted to make war. And he kind of got George Washington on his side for that. Right. And so Adams was actually afraid that Hamilton was going to start a coup in order to make war. I forgot if it was with the French or English. You know, it was like one side of the other. I should remember that, but I don't. Anyway, I kind of lost my chain of thought. But the Bank of the U.S. So he started the Bank of the U.S. so he could pay for wars because he knew that being able to print money was the essence of war-making capability because this is what the Romans discovered. If the Romans could take the Roman coin, which was silver, and force people to take it by printing the emperor on one side and the governor on the other or something, and then tell people it's worth more than the silver that's in it, then they could collect all that extra money. But at some point, that game would be up, and at some point, they would also not want to even have the silver in it, so they started adding copper. Mm-hmm. And that was depreciating the coin of the realm. Mm-hmm. And whenever you had a war, people would depreciate the coin of the realm. Mm-hmm. Now, the British, in order to fight the French, invented the perfect depreciation. So what they discovered was a whole bunch of bankers in Britain in the late 1600s went to the king and said, look, we got a scheme here. That we can help you pay the war with France, not raise taxes, completely screw the people, and nobody will be the wiser. And the way they did that was they said, just let all of us banks, if you help us so we don't compete with each other, put us all together in one big group, will be called the Bank of England. And what we'll do is, in exchange for you putting us together like this, we will start issuing paper money instead of silver money and gold money. We will issue a pound note, but we'll say this pound note is good for so much silver. And then what we'll do is because not everybody's going to come for their silver at once, we can issue more of these notes than we actually have silver. And then if you really get desperate, we can stop even giving people silver for the notes and print as many as you want and force people to take the paper anyway. And that's called inflation, and that's how the king was able to pay for his war, and also it was how the American colonies paid for the revolution by printing money and making the money worthless. So this game's been played for a long time.
So Phil, you gave us the historical background.
Uh-huh.
Now, what are the concrete steps that your party is planning to take to dismantle that system?
The funny thing is that there's a lot of libertarians who want to try to be not too controversial. And so there's that, like the Cato Institute, they don't even talk about the banking system. And that's why they've been a complete failure when they talked about Social Security privatization.
Right.
So they want to do all these little free market ideas. And, you know, you got your free market ideas meddling in South America and stuff. So you got all these little free marketers that are sort of afraid to touch the basic fraud, which is a central bank.
Right.
And so it's taken me months on the Libertarian Discussion Board just to bring over a significant number of people in the Libertarian Party to this idea. It's considered very radical. And how we go from here to there is a difficult question. I think it actually the best way to do it is just a revolution. Just like you had the Russian Revolution.
Right.
I mean, there'll be winners and there'll be losers, and it'll be really tough. The other way to do it is to gradually go inflate your way into it. But I hate inflation. Inflation's horrible for people. So you just say, okay, you set yourself a target, like gold. Like gold is going to be worth all the banks are going to have enough gold to back their dollars. For every deposit that they have, they're going to have one 1/10,000th of an ounce of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right now, gold's selling for $600
right.
an ounce. And then they'll have to start accumulating the gold at $600 an ounce. It'd be easy to do to back up all their deposits at the rate of $10,000 an ounce. So gradually, eventually, we'll get to the end of inflation where they can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to make sure that depositors are responsible for their own money. Because right now, the banks take money from depositors, and they loan out a lot more,
mm-hmm.
and nobody's responsible for what the bank's loans are. The depositors don't care because they know they're guaranteed. They're either guaranteed by their deposit insurance, or they know they're guaranteed by the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
That the Federal Reserve will, if that bank goes bad, the Federal Reserve will buy all the bad asset, you know, just pay off all the depositors with newly created money. So depositors all love this system because it makes their deposits, they think, safe.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is their deposits aren't safe because they get eaten by inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And the inflation goes to pay for wars.
Right.
And the inflation goes to pay for
overcost for the rich people.
All the things for the rich people, the real estate boom.
Right.
You know what? My idea of gradualism has the problem of, you know, how do you get there from here?
A gradual revolution. What a refreshing concept.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, Phil, I wasn't going to bring it up, but
okay.
You did talk about this young, sexy gentleman that you met in Baltimore who opened the realm of libertarian ideology to you.
Uh-huh.
You're a gay man.
Uh-huh.
You have also impaired sight,
yes,
from a devastating opportunistic infection, CMV retinitis.
That's right.
You're a survivor,
right,
with HIV.
Right.
What does it mean in terms of running for Congress? What does it mean in terms of how you are perceived within your party and the general community? I must say that you impressed the hell out of me. You go to the gym, for Christ's sake. This man works out. Well, I said my $5 by the computer. So tell me, how does that all play into the context that you are a gay man running for Congress?
Well, I haven't really I'm not in the closet,
right,
but I don't put my identity as a gay man
You don't use it as a demagogical tool.
I don't use it.
You don't need the compassion. You don't need...
Yeah, compassion is way overrated.
Thank you.
Horribly overrated.
Thank you.
I like when people are polite and helpful. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I rejected a lot of help. But I belong to a support group that the Lighthouse for the Blind does.
Oh, yes.
The Lighthouse is a terrific organization.
It really is. Right down Van Ness. Yeah.
They do an absolutely fabulous job. They've got fantastic people that are very dedicated. They've been a very big help to me, and I'm sure they're a much bigger help to people even blinder than me. For a while I used to be like rude to people who were too helpful to me, but I stopped doing that because I realized there's a lot of blind people who really need the help.
Right.
And if they don't get it, they're really stuck. So people can't tell how blind I am just by looking at me. So I graciously accept whatever help they offer
because help is condescending and overbearing at times.
Right, it's condescending and overbearing, and I try to accept it anyway.
Right,
just because I want that help to go to people who really need it. I'm not going to hide my condition if people bring it out because they tend to in these interviews and stuff. It's great because, libertarians are often accused of being cold-hearted and cruel, and I want to make it sure that really we're
you
the kindest.
You definitely defeat that image.
Right. And I believe the philosophy fundamentally works against that, but it takes a long conversation to get to that point. Let me just talk for a second about one other issue there, and that is financial preparedness to have HIV. In my former, I used to be an industrial hygienist. I was occupational safety and health consultant, and I consulted with a lot of the large real estate interests in San Francisco. And some of those interests asked me to contribute to various in order as a kind of a condition of business to contribute to various political campaigns. So I was asked to contribute to Ted Kennedy's campaign many years ago. And needless to say, Ted Kennedy's philosophy is sort of opposite that of libertarian philosophy.
Right.
So I said, okay, I will give Ted Kennedy $500 on condition that I write a letter to Ted Kennedy and he personally writes me back. So I wrote a letter to Ted Kennedy. I said, Dear Senator Kennedy, rather than, help people with AIDS with government money, make us dependent and beg for it and grovel for it and deal with all the indignities of getting assistance from a government organization, why don't you just simply give those who are HIV positive a big tax break so we can save for our inevitable...
Most people we know have to spend down to zero to be entitled to any social services.
Right. And on top of that, what their whole working life, they were paying half their money to the government, allegedly so the government could help blind people.
Right.
What really infuriates me, talk to me about condescending, what really infuriates me is the first line on the 1040... which is the long tax form. The first line is a deduction for blind people.
Mm.
First of all, anybody who's making any money doesn't get to take a deduction.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, it's so despicably condescending. It's like, good guys. The first thing we're going to show people is a deduction for blind people so they can feel good about their taxes that go to war.
Okay. You've been listening to Phil Berg, running for Congress as a libertarian. I hope that you come back.
Okay.
We're going to have some debates involving progressive candidates in September.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to see you mingle with Chrissy, for example.
Chrissy and I see eye to eye on 50%.
Yes. Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
The best of luck to you both.
Thank you. You're
listening to San Francisco Village Voice on Enemy Combatant Radio every Friday at 4. We'll be right back. We're back with Phil Berg. We're back with Phil Berg, Libertarian candidate for Congress in California. So, Phil, how do people find out about your campaign? What is your website?
My website is www.choosepeacenow.us.
Excellent. And that's one word, correct?
That's correct.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you very much, Misha.
All right. And again, we wanted to mention the event that Iriselli Foundation hosted for the families of Asa Sullivan and Oliver Lafitte, a.k.a. Big O, two victims of a shameful spree of murder by SFPD back in June in San Francisco. And Phil was there and spoke at the event. So was my compa here, Fernando Venceramos, who was at the grill and worked his butt off all day. And that was not his first time. He was here also helping us out at our second Civil Rights Revival cookout in Bayview on June 4th. So how did you feel the event went?
Actually, it went very well, Misha. A lot of lovely people. And I was able to read again another one from one of my poems, especially written just for you. That's called Grandmama's Got a Shotgun.
Yeah.
And in understanding that grandma does have a shotgun is a type of justice we need. And since every soul is important, every soul needs to be validated. The souls of every grandmother, it's time for them to get out there and start kicking up dust because it's their world too. And for the Bayview Hunters Point, I have a play called Grandmother's Patrol where they kick the kick the crooked police out and they take over the Bayview Hunters Point. And that's a play. And then working on trying to get it to going, if anyone's interested in trying to put that play together.
I'm game. I'm going to help you spread that word.
It's a gift to that community. And if I can, one quick small poem.
All right.
And this is called Eraser Man. There I stood that early morn, putting on my coat, strapping on my boots, extending my hand to the front door knob. Then Mother said, "Where are you going with that giant eraser?" "Well, Mother, it came to me in a dream." "But why such a giant eraser?" she asked. "Well, the lines that divide people, they merely and simply just need to be erased. And what better way than with this wonderful giant eraser to erase the barriers, the walls, the lines that keeps us all apart? So is it okay? Is it okay that I go? For there are way too many barriers, walls, and lines needing to be erased just so humanity can have the opportunity to feel and live close together. And I wish to make it so. Can I do it, Mother? I want to be the Eraser Man."
The Eraser Man.
Thank you, LaVisha.
God, I wish I had an eraser. Wow. That felt good.
And the important thing about community is knowing that we can heal it, we can bring it close together, and gain experience in being closer, and knowing that we can touch each other and have voice. And here at Enemy Combatant Radio, we all have voice, we all have value.
Here we go.
Amen.
And actually, we had some preliminary conversations also at our event on Sunday to stage this year, October 22nd, Against Police Brutality Coalition and Criminalization of a Generation right here in San Francisco for the Bay Area. And some agencies are interested to join. Of course, the families of Oliver Lafitte and Asa Sullivan, also the African American Community Policing Relations Board, the Latino Policing Board, the API, Asian Pacific Islander Board, 022, October 22nd, locally here in the Bay Area, Bay Area Police Watch, which is based at Ella Baker Center in Oakland, Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. And so we're working on that, and Code Pink also, and probably ANSWER, and American Friend Society, United Peace of Justice. So we can do something big. The problem is that a lot of those organizations have had some nasty cat fights about outreach, about who is in the limelight, who has been springing what. And it might be the opportunity to do some true coalition building, to forget egos and personalities, and CAF files for funding and just do it together this time.
I have a young
Why can't we get along, right?
I have a young boy who wants to use his eraser.
Hey, hey, that's it. Well, let's have you over there with the giant eraser to start from fresh. So that's what I'm interested to work on now. We got 2 months to go, and that's what Idris Deli Foundation is all about, coalition building and trying to erase that all hurt and ego bruising, and because there's no more time for that.
And we got to get rid of that shrub in Washington, D.C. We chop it down.
Wow.
Amen.
I'm hip. Well, we're about to get off the air unless our whiz technician and father here of Enemy Combatant Radio want to say a word. And he's just handing me out a paper. He's been forcing me to learn my own technology here on the radio today. And here is, we were supposed to have Paul from Youth Peak on the show, but he had to leave early, and he left us a document about Bayview Magic. Bayview Magic 2006 Back to School Backpack Program. And this is, MAGIC stands for Mobilization for Adolescent Growth in Our Communities. And they are based in Bayview. And if you want to find out more about Bayview MAGIC, I'm trying to find the link here. Is Bayview the email address is bayviewmagic@yahoo.com. And bear with me. The website is www.bayviewmagic.com. And it's a group that has been formed to support the children of Bayview Hunters Point in San Francisco and to help create a supportive network of services to create a positive and safe environment for children. 2 days ago, a 5-year-old child was shot drive-by shooting in a Crocker Amazon playground in the Excelsior in the Mission District. That is, you know, it doesn't even sink in. I got a call from Carol Migden's office saying, what can we do? This just happened, and I was speechless. I didn't know how to respond. It reminded me of times when I was growing up in the Basque Country. When the Guardia Civil wouldn't kill you, they would kill your child. So you would live with the memory and you would watch your child die. And who is behind those murders? I do not believe Sophie Maxwell and Ross Mercurimi version that only a handful of people are committing those murders and that the DA should prosecute them and that we should increase beat cops at each corner to prevent crime. We have seen that happen in Richmond. They increased the police presence threefold in Richmond 7 months ago, and the crime rate went up. So obviously this is not the solution. We do know that some of those shootings are also carefully crafted by law enforcement to justify their criminalization of certain neighborhoods that are palatable for land grab. Let's get real. So all our love and care towards the family of the child who miraculously survived. It is time for coalition building. It is not time for several groups, grassroots or otherwise, to fight against each other to get some a pitiful amount of city and county money. Okay? This is the time for all of us to get together and force city government to come up with real solution, which means true community policing. Not more law enforcement, but true community policing and real resources in poor neighborhoods where there is crappy air to breathe, which means ADD and the whole host of other illness, physical and mental, that it brings, where there is no child care, no decent high schools, no health care, no training, no jobs. Of course there's going to be crime. Okay? We're about to be completely phagocyted, vampirized by white people in Bayview-Hunters Point. And of course the crime is going to go up. Don't quote me on this one, but I would love to go rob Starbucks once they move into my neighborhood. Okay? Okay, I didn't say that. I didn't say it. I'm too old. I might have some skeleton in my closet, but I ain't playing no more. Anyhow, so Phil is cracking up. Say, oh, no, she didn't. Okay, so that's what's up. And we hope that your listeners want to find out more. Next time, please give us a call on Friday at 4 p.m. every Friday on San Francisco Village Voice at 415-864-1006. You're listening to San Francisco Village Voice on Enemy Combatant Radio, Indie Media. Yeah.